I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us this afternoon. Journalist Liza Mundy says, on the campaign trail, Michelle Obama's most important role was to explain Barack Obama, to make sense of him for voters. Now she's taking on another political function, promoting her husband's policy priorities, helping pitch his economic stimulus package, for example. Both roles have been a departure for Michelle Obama. Mundy says she was once ambivalent about politics. Liza Mundy, author of the biography Michelle, is our guest this afternoon. In the early pages of the book, Mundy says the task of explaining Barack Obama was critical because his story is a complicated one, the son of a mother from Kansas and a father from Kenya who grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia. But Mundy says when Michelle Obama talks about him, he's just a regular guy. As for Michelle Obama, she's complicated too. Mundy says she can be funny and sharp-tongued, warm and blunt, empathic and demanding. Mundy says she is said to be an extremely loyal friend, and she loves reruns of The Brady Bunch and The Dick Van Dyke Show. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon about Michelle Obama for Liza Mundy. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Liza Mundy is a staff writer at The Washington Post, where for the past 10 years she's covered politics, popular culture, and women's issues. She's also a regular contributor to the online magazine Slate. Her book, Michelle, a Biography, is published by Simon & Schuster. And again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Liza Mundy, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. How have Michelle Obama's feelings about politics changed over time?
Well, I think that they've certainly become more positive. She, just as you said in your excellent introduction, as recently as 2004, she remarked to an interviewer that she sometimes thought politics was a waste of time, and she certainly resisted many of her husband's political campaigns and decisions to run, including his decision to run for the Senate and then his decision to run for presidency. She was one of the sort of strongest skeptics, but clearly embraced his campaign and did a great deal to help with the campaign and and presumably now has done a 180 in terms of what she believes politics and politicians can accomplish.
Yeah, it's interesting because on the one hand, in a sense, I feel that she's always been politically aware without necessarily being engaged in politics. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. I mean, she's talked in interviews about when she and Barack Obama first met, you know, that they really bonded over discussions of community change and social change. And so she has certainly, you know, in her adult life always wanted the same things that he has and been interested in the same social goals. And one of the things that's a little bit puzzling is she says that when they first met and for certainly the first years of their marriage, she really didn't think he was going to go into politics and maybe wasn't even aware of his political aspirations, whereas people who knew him at Harvard and who knew him, you know, in the early days of his being a lawyer say, you know, it was always clear that he had political aspirations. So, you know, maybe she just sort of hoped she could divert his course. But certainly, I think she's a person who's always been very socially aware. And so she clearly always knew that it was a possibility for him.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You write that she harbored a quiet commitment to social change, and she was more comfortable doing pro bono work for the poor at Harvard when she was there in law school than looking to build her resume with awards and more prestigious activities.
Yes, I think that she has always been torn between whether sort of success for her lay in helping the community that she came from. She's from Southside Chicago, as I think probably everybody knows by now, which is a large and, you know, and diverse area of the city. She grew up in a very comfortably middle-class, sort of working middle-class neighborhood, but was very aware, you know, that portions of Southside had not done as well as her neighborhood and that people she grew up with had not done as well as she had in terms of being able to seize opportunities that became available to African Americans in the 1970s and 80s. And so she retained a commitment to her larger community and certainly wanted to help people, but she also felt that success also might lie in sort of conventional corporate success. And I think, you know, both she and her older brother Craig have talked about how important it was to them to make their parents proud. And she wrote in her senior thesis at Princeton pretty honestly about, you know, arriving at an Ivy League campus, seeing sort of the better things in life that were available to her classmates, feeling the very powerful peer pressure to go into corporate law, you know, or some other lucrative career. And I think for part of her career as an adult, she really sort of went back and forth between those two goals and pursued them sometimes simultaneously. As you say, when she was at Harvard Law, she spent a lot of her time working for the Legal Aid Bureau, and she would have been helping residents from the Cambridge area and surrounding counties, lower-income people who needed help with civil cases involving, you know, housing disputes and child custody. So, you know, she was obviously interested in accomplishing both things at the same time when she was at Harvard, bettering her own prospects, you know, understandably wanting to do that, and at the same time trying to help people who had not done as well as she had.
Hmm. She didn't cooperate on this book. Why not?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. When I began working on it in earnest in the winter of last year, she was a fairly polarizing figure on the campaign trail. You know, polls showed that people who liked her a lot, but that there was also a portion of the public who was skeptical about her or thought that she was too angry or too negative. And certainly there was a concerted effort on the part of some of Barack Obama's political opponents to kind of fan the flames of, you know, of skepticism about her. And I think there was just a feeling on the part of the campaign that they wanted to sort of stay in protective mode, keep their heads down, and you know, try to prevent anybody from saying anything that might go viral on the internet during the campaign.
Does that continue to be the case with her? Does she have any kind of relationship at this point with reporters, with the press?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not actively covering her for the Washington Post now, but I certainly have colleagues who are, you know, who are working to gain access both to her for events and to her friends and colleagues in Washington. And she's brought into the White House some of her good friends and colleagues from Chicago. And obviously, journalists now are working to develop relationships and sort of, you know, things are gradually opening up. To my knowledge, she doesn't have, a strong relationship, you know, ongoing relationship with any particular reporter. But, you know, it's interesting. At the Post, I sit near the reliable source, which is sort of our gossip and not so much a gossip columnist, but, you know, a report on sightings of people. And they're so active now, because one thing about the Obamas is they have really been getting out and about in Washington. And she's been, you know, seen taking her girls to the movies and things like that. So the source reporters are always, you know, calling up now movie theaters and restaurants to report on Obama sightings. And which I must say is really sort of nice to see, because they are making a very concerted effort to have a presence in Washington and to establish a relationship between the White House and the greater D.C. community. And I think everybody in the D.C. area really sort of enjoys the idea that there are going to be regular first couple sightings, you know, around the city at various places, you know, from Ben's Chili Bowl to the Kennedy Center.
Yeah. And the children make it also very interesting for people that, you know, we're interested in the children.
Yes, and I think, you know, one of the difficult things for them is going to be how to manage that, and how to make available to the public, you know, photos of the family and some sense of the family, which there is a great deal of curiosity. And I think, you know, people really enjoy seeing photos of the girls in the White House surroundings, because they are such engaging young people. And but also, the Obamas do want to protect their privacy, and they've talked about that. And I think they're still figuring out how to manage that and make them somewhat available, but not too available.
Yeah, I can certainly see why they want to have grandmother Marian Robinson on hand.
Yes, well, Barack Obama described her really, I think, as the unsung hero of the campaign. She has really been there as the primary babysitter. During the campaign, Michelle Obama would travel one day a week. I mean, she set pretty clear boundaries for what she was willing to do. She would travel one day, possibly sometimes 2 days a week. And when she was away, Marian Robinson would be the primary caregiver for the daughters. And one person I spoke to who was at a table with Michelle Obama during the campaign, just a lunch table, saw her blackberrying with her mom because she had just found out that one of the girls' soccer games had been canceled or soccer practice. And so, you know, like every working mother, she was blackberrying her mother to say, you know, can you pick them up here instead of here? So she has certainly been a mainstay for the family up to now. And I'm sure this is the first time that the Obama family has actually moved to Washington. When Barack Obama entered the U.S. Senate in 2005, they made the decision to stay in Chicago because they had such a powerful network of friends and supporters there. So this is their first move to Washington, and I'm sure that having their grandmother there provides a lot of continuity.
Yeah. Well, that gets us back to Chicago now. For Michelle and Craig Robinson and their parents, Marion and Fraser Robinson III, what was their family life like? It was, I would imagine that this has given Michelle Obama a very good blueprint for what she wants to do with her family now.
Yes, they had a very solid, strong upbringing with their parents, obviously a two-parent family, children very close to the parents. They lived in a neighborhood called South Shore, which is had traditionally been a white neighborhood in Chicago, which is, I'm sure your listeners know better than I do. Chicago traditionally is a city of neighborhoods. For years and years and years, there were very clear ethnic and racial distinctions. This was a neighborhood that the houses had actually had, you know, restrictive covenants at one point, saying that they couldn't be sold to black families. But in the 60s and 70s, obviously things began to open up. Her parents moved onto a very nice street in South Shore and grew up in a very cohesive household with, you know, all of the sort of standard extracurriculars available to the children. They, you know, she had piano lessons. They regularly visited the art institute. They could leave their bikes in the front yard. Her brother was a great basketball player. And you know, they had dinner together every night. They played board games. They didn't have a luxurious or you know, affluent upbringing, but they had a very solid, stable upbringing with a large extended family, both from her father's side of the family and her mother's side of the family. So, and Barack Obama has talked about how, you know, in addition to his attraction to Michelle Robinson, as her name was at the time, he was so attracted to her large and extended family in Chicago, which was something obviously that he had not experienced growing up. And one of the things that I would have liked to have been able to ask her, that the Robinson family moved into this neighborhood when she was a very young girl. It was undergoing a complete racial transformation from being all white to virtually all black. And one of the things that I've wondered is how aware she was of white flight, which was taking place when she was a young girl. Was she aware that white families were moving away as African-American families were moving in, or did she become aware sort of only at the point where the neighborhood had completely turned over? And, you know, how aware was she of the greater racial tensions in Chicago that persisted certainly in the 60s and 70s, and how much was she shielded from that by growing up in this large, very comfortable, loving, and supported African-American community?
Yeah.
It's an interesting question that I haven't completely resolved.
Yeah, it is a very interesting question. It seems that race for her, she was protected because race doesn't get to be really in her face until she's at Princeton.
I think that's right. I mean, Craig has said that they had discussions with their parents about racial discrimination. I'm sure they could not have ignored it in their family, you know, and that their parents tried to prepare them for the reality that they had confronted and said to them, you know, you can try it. You must try always as hard as you can. Sometimes, despite, you know, how hard you've tried, you're not going to get the goal that you're after. Now, this, of course, is true for everybody growing up, but it might have been particularly true for African Americans in their parents' lifetimes and trying to prepare them for racial discrimination. Craig has said, you know, that always seems so unfair to me. But I think in the larger community, I think what you said is exactly right, that racism would not have been in her face until she got outside of Southside Chicago and experienced the campus on Princeton. When she was in high school, she did travel to a completely different part of Chicago and attended Whitney Young Magnet High School in a different part of the city. You know, as early as 13 or 14, she was using public transportation to travel an hour and a half to a completely different neighborhood in Chicago, and she did have white classmates there at Whitney Young. But the people that I've interviewed described it as being a very special place because at that time in Chicago, magnet schools were fairly recent creations. They did pull from all over the city. Whitney Young had a majority African-American student body, and so there were plenty of leadership opportunities and a sense of solidarity for the African-American students. And the white students who were there were self-selected in the sense that they came from families who had stayed in the city and had parents who wanted their children to experience a diverse environment. And I think in the 70s and early 80s, that was rarer than it is now. I think parents generally want diversity now for their children, but didn't necessarily then. So she would have been going to school with white classmates who I think came from sort of unusually progressive-minded families. Mm. And so I think that would have been a fairly easy transition into an integrated environment. And then, you know, not to be too critical of Princeton, but it would have been a very different experience.
Yeah, well, she had a roommate whose mother didn't want her daughter bunking with an African-American.
Yes, I must say, I was really shocked when I read that. I was at Princeton around the same time. I started there in 78. She started in 81. We would have overlapped by a year, and I thought I had some sense of what the campus was like, but she happened to draw a roommate from New Orleans whose mother, just as you say, when she found she was going to be rooming with an African-American student, was very unhappy about that and called everybody she knew to try and get her daughter moved. And Both of those women, the daughter and the mother, came forward during the campaign, were inspired by the candidacy of Barack Obama to come forward and talk about this and express their regret. And the mother even said, you know, boy, the joke was on me. Here I thought I was protecting my daughter from someone who, you know, would eventually be the First Lady of the United States. And I think they were appealingly, you know, honest and contrite about that. But it must have been, and the roommate has said that she hoped that, you know, even then she said it was my secret shame that my mother was doing this, and she hoped that Michelle hadn't known. But, you know, it's hard to know what she did know, and she has not said a lot about that and what she was aware of. She's been pretty diplomatic mm-hmm. about it.
Yeah.
But it would have been, you know, I've said in talking about Princeton at the time, I came from a very different environment than Michelle Obama. I came from sort of a small city on the outskirts of Appalachia in Virginia, and it was, the campus was so dominated by sort of traditional Northeastern affluent, you know, prep school kind of culture that even coming just from the South and from a fairly rural community in the South, it was so different. And coming from a strongly rooted regional community, as Michelle did, I immediately felt very different on campus. I mean, there were people who couldn't understand the way that I said my name because my Southern kind of mountain accent was so strong. And so if you were a different kind of student, and a woman also, because women had only been on campus for about a decade, you were immediately made mm-hmm. to feel your difference. And I'm sure that that must have been, you know, all the more true for her. And another important thing that was going on at Princeton at the time, the president of Princeton, William Bowen, had been in the forefront of fashioning an affirmative action policy that was being copied by other schools at the time, in which there were no racial quotas, but race was one criterion that could be taken into account in school admissions, along with, you know, grades and whether you were an alumni legacy and your athletic ability. It could all be sort of rolled up in one package. And there was some resistance to this policy on campus from both undergraduates and alumni. And the period of time when she was on the campus of Princeton it was when issues like affirmative action were being hotly debated. And she I've interviewed other classmates who can remember letters to the editor being written in the alumni publication saying that black students on campus were bringing down intellectual standards and, you know, and being asked what their SAT scores were and just sort of constant subtle implications that they didn't belong on campus or, you know, weren't up to the standards of other students, which is, you know, absurd because traditionally, you know, alumni students had been given preferences. There are all sorts of reasons why you might get a preference. So I think that would have been a particularly maybe unsettling time to be African American on an Ivy League campus.
Yeah, and for Michelle Robinson at that point, sorting through all these things as a young woman of 18, 19, 20, 21, it had to be maybe a little rough, and maybe that offers us some context for her senior thesis, which has been controversial. You write, probably one of the most debated and analyzed the school has produced.
Yes, well, I think all Princeton alums felt a sort of a collective shudder when we heard that her thesis had been, you know, posted online because, you know, really, God forbid that one thesis ever get posted online. I'm so relieved that my husband will never run for president and nor will I. And, you know, to have to have your undergraduate self, everybody knows how theses are produced and certainly, you know, students work hard on them, but a lot, you know, a substantial amount might be written at the last minute, you know, with suggestions of your advisor sort of shoehorned in because you know your advisor is going to be grading it. And to sort of think of that all being exhumed 20, 25 years later and poured over by opposition researchers is really sort of unsettling to contemplate. But in fact, in her thesis, she was a sociology major, and so she wrote quite honestly about the about her feelings of being an African-American student on this campus that had only recently begun admitting African-American students in any number. And she says, I really was made to feel that I was black for the first time when I went to Princeton. And people, you know, some people seem to find that a shocking conclusion and evidence of, you know, inclinations to racial separatism, but I just found it so easy to believe, again, because I literally didn't realize I was a Southerner until I went to Princeton. And it was so easy to believe that an African-American student would be made aware of her race, particularly somebody who had grown up in this warm and embracing African-American community, as Michelle did. It did not seem remarkable to me at all that she would have written a sentence like that. And then she goes on to explore the question of that many students sort of struggled with on campus. To what extent do you assimilate into this environment? To what extent do you hang out with your own, with people who are familiar to you and going through the same thing you are? You know, in her case, students of color, but Jewish students experience the same thing. Asian American students experience the same thing. Do I hang out with people who are having the same experience I am, or do I assimilate somewhat? And she actually interviewed alumni who had already graduated and asked them, you know, did you assimilate or self-segregate more when you were at Princeton, and how would you compare this to both before Princeton and afterwards? And she found that the impulse to self-segregate for most people was strongest when they were on the campus. And she posited that maybe this was because they didn't have their families with them, like when they were in high school, at least at the end of the day, they would have gone home to their families. And since they didn't have that, maybe that was why people stuck together. And I think, you know, in that part of her thesis, she sounds in part like a young woman who misses her parents and misses her brother, who graduated when she was a sophomore. But she also, I think, asks in her thesis, am I still the same person I was when I came to Princeton? To what extent have I been changed by this campus? When I came to Princeton, I knew that my goal in life was to help people from the community that I left behind, the community that I come from. Now I'm not so sure what my life's purpose is. I've seen the other opportunities available in life. I do feel the same peer pressure that my classmates feel to go to law school or whatever. And I really felt as though she was honestly exploring many of the things that that students are exploring, questions of identity and roots, that when they're in college.
Our guest this afternoon, Liza Mundy. She's a staff writer at The Washington Post. She's also the author of Michelle, a biography. It is a biography of Michelle Obama. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the questions I think it would be fascinating to ask Michelle Obama is about during her time at Princeton in 1983, Harold Washington was elected mayor of Chicago. And this gets us around also to talking about Michelle Obama's father, Fraser Robinson III, who has to have played a major, major role in his daughter's life. She loved him dearly. Tell us about him. He worked for the city.
Yes, he worked for the water department. He was supervised the boilers, and it was a job that required expertise and you know, engineering knowledge that he clearly acquired on the job. But it was a steady working class city job. It wasn't an exalted position. But she has written about how important it was to her as a role model that he got up and went to work every day, and how much he valued his job, particularly because he developed multiple sclerosis at a fairly early age, and this was a fairly physically demanding job, and it could not have been easy for him to perform it, particularly as his condition got more acute in later life. But important to know also is that he was a volunteer precinct captain for at least part of his adult life. And it was his job to go around and get out the vote and get people in the communities down to the polls. And this was a position of some sort of, you would be a fairly locally important political figure. You were also the go-to person when citizens needed dead trees removed or snow removal or things like that, that you could sort of, you should be able to just expect the city to do anyway. But in Chicago, the way it worked was, you know, you had to go to the precinct captain and they would get these things done for you. And then the hope was that you would be so grateful to the city that you would go down to the polls and vote. Of course, the first Mayor Daley was mayor at the time, and he was the head of the fabled Daley political machine. And so her father worked, you know, in a fairly sort of close to the streets capacity for the Daley machine, It's quite likely that this was how he got his city job, because patronage, of course, was rampant at the time, and particularly for an African American, it was pretty much necessary to perform quote unquote volunteer political work in order to get that good city job. And it sounds as though he was a very congenial person, much like his daughter, and someone who probably would have enjoyed the conviviality of getting out the vote. But it was also an ambiguous sort of job to hold, because at the time, Chicago was a terribly segregated city, and schools were very segregated, and segregated housing was a big problem. And the Daley machine was basically upholding that system. And so in the largest sense, he would have been working on behalf of a system that was not ultimately in his favor or that of his family. And certainly all of the compromises and ambiguities of Chicago politics may well be why she grew up a feeling skeptical about politics. And apparently the whole Robinson family was skeptical about politics and politicians, and I'm sure, you know, had good reason for that. She has said that her father was the only person who really liked and enjoyed politics in the family. And when Barack Obama met her and was attempting to ingratiate himself into this larger Robinson family he so admired, he had a real uphill battle because, you know, he was fairly open about his interest in politics. And when he first was having some preliminary conversations with her brother Craig, who was kind of vetting him, and he said, you know, that he'd like to run for political office one day. Craig said, well, you know, that's great, but don't tell Aunt Gracie. You know, you might not want to be sort of broadcasting your aspirations to our family.
Yeah. Talk with us a little bit more about Craig and Michelle. There's a wonderful little story you tell in the book about them growing up and playing office.
Yes, I think Craig said, you know, everybody in the family sort of acknowledges the fact that Michelle was a very independent-minded child and you know, had a very strong personality. Her mom has talked about the fact that, you know, she taught both her kids to read before they went to school, but that Michelle was sort of more resistant than Craig, more kind of independent-minded and sort of wanted to wait till she was ready. And Craig says that they used to play office, and he would be the boss and she would be the secretary, but then he wouldn't have anything to do because she would assign herself all the work. And clearly they have a very, very close relationship. Craig is, like Michelle, he sort of first explored the world of corporate America. He worked on Wall Street for, I think, about a decade. And he talks very engagingly about all the money that he was making and how absurd it was. He made fun in one interview about his buying like a I can't remember if it's a BMW station wagon or a Volvo station. I think it was a BMW station wagon, and what a ridiculous car it was, and how he overpaid for it, and just sort of poking fun at kind of the culture of money and the excesses that it can lead you to. And he did end up leaving Wall Street and pursuing his first love, which is basketball, and is the coach now at Oregon State. And so I think he also vacillated between, you know, is success and satisfaction, does it lie in financial success and being able to have the kind of job that was unavailable to my parents, or does it lie in pursuing something that gives me greater satisfaction? And he ended up, you know, choosing the latter. But they continue to have a very close relationship and to talk on the phone all the time. And I think it must be kind of you know, strange for Craig, because when they were at Princeton, he was the dominant sibling. I mean, he was the basketball star, and she was Craig Robinson's little sister. Mm-hmm. And he thinks, actually, that that sort of got in the way of her dating life, because people were so aware of his brotherly presence around. And he was a big deal on campus. And now he's Michelle Obama's big brother, you know, so there's been kind of a role reversal. They seem to have handled it quite well, but I think it must be just sort of mind-boggling still.
Yeah. I think for all three of these individuals, Craig, Michelle, Barack, this idea of, you know, where do you find yourself in the world? What is your mission, if you would, has been really important.
That's a very good way to put it. What is your mission? And, you know, it's interesting. There was in The New Yorker about a month or so ago, they ran excerpts of quotes that Barack and Michelle gave in 1996 when a photojournalist was interviewed them for a book on couples. And ironically enough, Michelle and Barack Obama were edited out of this book because back in 1996 they weren't, I guess, considered prominent or interesting enough. But the photos remain what they said about each other remains. And it was so interesting to read because Michelle Obama did go to a corporate law firm right out of Harvard. She did pursue sort of the corporate mission and clearly on a number of levels was not satisfied with that work. And what's interesting in the quote, she talks about how it was really Barack Obama who persuaded her that she didn't have to pursue this conventional path to success, that she could have a life that was more interesting to her and more satisfying and more adventurous. So at the same time that she offered to him stability and these, you know, extended Chicago roots and this extended family and her own personality, he was offering her something as well, which was a vision of life that was less conventional and you know, a sense of adventure and that there are other things out there you can do with your life if you want to. And it's really interesting to see how they complemented each other and I think offered each other something that, you know, up to then had been sort of missing.
A mentor for her at Sidley Austin was Steve Carlson. And without him, we might not have had Michelle Obama.
Yes, and this is I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I think Michelle Obama, I think, does retain a sense of having been underestimated and discriminated against, and I'm sure that she was at times in her life, and she dwells sort of on the high school and college counselors who didn't think she was good enough to go to Princeton or didn't think she was good enough to go to Harvard, and the people who sort of didn't help her. And of course we all have people like that in our lives, but there were people who helped her. And in some cases, they were unlikely. And Steve Carlson is a partner at Sidley Austin. He's a Princeton graduate himself. When he was there, the campus was still all male. He's basically, you know, conservative and Republican, but he believes in the Princeton Alumni Network. He believes in newcomers being admitted to campus. We had a long talk about that. You know, he believes that it's important to have sort of fresh perspectives and newcomers and to keep the campus vibrant and alive. And he believed that it was his obligation to help any Princeton graduate who came to him for help. And she did write him when she was an undergraduate at Princeton and was thinking about the law and asked if there were any summer positions at Sidley Austin. And he wrote her back and said, you know, they really just hired law students in the summers. But he wrote down a couple of organizations that he thought might, you know, be possibilities for her, and he remembered her. And when a couple years had passed and he thought she might be in law school, he actually wrote her at her childhood address and said, you know, if indeed you did go to law school and if you ever want to talk about the law, you know, I'd be glad to take you to lunch. And she did respond to him, and he took her to lunch and just talked to her about the various opportunities in the law. And she later told people at Sidley Austin that one of the reasons that she went to work there was because Steve Carlson had been so nice to her. And I think, you know, it's important that to keep in mind that she has received help along the way, sometimes from unlikely places, and that Princeton might have been a difficult environment, but it does have a fanatically loyal career, you know, alumni network, and she did benefit from that.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Liza Mundy, author of the biography Michelle. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. This is addressed to Lisa. Lisa, you have done a very good job, and I appreciate the information that you've given us. But I do want to let you and many other of the speakers who are on this program at different times to think about the number of times that you insert the phrase, you know, into your sentences. Within one sentence, you said five times, you know, and I've kept a tally on how many times you said, you know. I quit at 70, but while waiting to be on the speaker here, you said at least five more, you knows, in the middle of the sentence. So it is really not complimentary to educated people, such as I know you are, but it's a habit that people get into, and I think it's very disturbing, and also it detracts from what you're saying.
Okay, well, you know, thanks for calling. Liza, you want to comment?
I'll certainly keep that in mind.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Questions about our topic this afternoon are invited, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What are your thoughts about Michelle Obama to date as an advocate for her husband's policy initiatives? And where do you suspect she might head in the future?
Well, I think that she's going to be a very active first lady, and she's clearly shown that already. She, at first, you know, talked about envisioning herself as mom-in-chief and sort of giving the impression that she was going to be largely concerned with raising their family in the White House. And I think that I sort of thought that she would spend the first couple of months getting her daughters settled in and building the social network of friends and parents that they had in Chicago. But really, you know, right from the first days of the administration, she was there speaking on behalf of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, a law that will make it easier for people to sue for racial or gender discrimination on the job. And not long after that, she was already out speaking to employees of federal agencies, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Education, but two agencies that, you know, would have a sort of particular impact on places like Southside Chicago. She was there kind of, you know, stumping for her husband's stimulus package and getting them on board, but also saying thank you to them as federal workers. I think it is her view that military families and civil servants are sometimes underappreciated, and I think she does genuinely want to say thank you to people who are in public service. So, you know, right from the start, she has not wasted any time. The hours in which her daughters are in school have been very busy for her, and also organizing events at the White House, inviting people to the White House, holding functions. They've said that they want it to be a more active and inclusive White House, and I think we're seeing that already. She has said that some of her initiatives that will be most important to her are promoting volunteerism and national service, working on behalf of military families in particular, who, again, I think she feels, you know, that their sacrifice may be underappreciated, and also the sort of large issue of work-family balance is something that's interesting to her as well. It should be, because she has spent so much time holding down the fort, you know, holding down a job herself and also being the primary caregiver while her husband has been campaigning first for the Senate and then for the presidency. So I think she will be active on these fronts, and she has certainly staffed her office with very experienced people, and it will be interesting to see whether she ultimately takes an active role in issues that are important to her, like, for example, job discrimination. And whether she takes on some areas that are sort of more harder edge than first ladies have traditionally, adopted as their causes.
Yeah. It was interesting to see early in your book the results of an AP poll taken last summer that found 30% of the public viewed her favorably, 35% unfavorably. What do you suppose the view is today?
Oh, much more positive. I mean, I think the polls have shown that she is one of the more popular incoming first ladies in recent history. So I think she has done, a really good job of winning over people. I certainly have found at book signings that many families have somebody, who is just a very staunch Michelle Obama fan. And there have been columns recently, about I just think she's winning people over in a lot of different ways, and part of it is the fashion and, just her attractiveness and dynamism, and a part of it is, it's her personality and her sense of humor, but she certainly seems to have, there's always been a core of people who I think really liked her outspokenness and frankness and sense of humor, but those who were skeptical, I think, many of them are being won over.
Mm. Any word from this circle of folks about how they view your book?
No, I haven't. I'll knock on wood. Better that generally than an angry call, I think. I mean, you get all sorts of things and you get used to it. But I haven't specifically heard their opinion.
Yeah. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Liza, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Liza Mundy is the author of Michelle, A Biography. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Les. Let's take a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon. March contract, 4.5 cents lower today. $4.99, the high, the low at 4.88 and a quarter. Settlement price at $4.90 and a quarter, 4.5 cents lower. May futures, 5.13, the high, the low at 4.98 and a half. Settlement price at 5.01 and three quarters, down 4 and a quarter. And July contract, 5.24, the high, the low at 10 and three quarters. Settlement price at $5.13 and three quarters, 4 and one quarter lower for the July. That's the harvest month in the soft red winter wheat pit from Chicago. March wheat in Kansas City, where the hard red wheat is traded, down 2 cents today at 5.38 and three quarters for the settlement price on that lead option. March corn futures back in Chicago, unchanged today, 3.47 and a half the high. Low at 340 and a quarter. Settlement price at 343 and a half. Once again, unchanged. May futures up a quarter at the end of the day. 354 and a quarter the high. The low at 47. Settlement price at 350 and a half. A quarter higher. July futures, 363 the high. The low at 56 and a half. Settlement price for the July corn, 359 and three quarters up a quarter. And September up a quarter. 372 the high. The low at 365 and three quarters. Settled at 368 and a half. Up a quarter. December futures, the harvest month, 384 and a half in the corn pit for the high. Range to a low at 377 and a half. Settlement price December corn $3.80 and three quarters of a cent a bushel, a half cent higher for the afternoon. And the March 2010 contract up a quarter at 392 and three quarters. December 2010 corn unchanged at 398 and three quarters. March oat futures down 5 and three quarters today, $1.75 and a quarter the high, the low. Actually, the high must have been $1.75 and three quarters. It's still finished down 5 and three quarters. That was the settlement price for the March oats. The May, $1.85, down 6 cents. Soy complex now. March bean futures, $8.66 the high, the low at 8.46 and a half. Settled 8.63, 14 and a half higher. May futures, 8.57 the high, the low at 8.41 and a quarter. Settlement price at 8.53 and a half, up 9 and a half cents. In July soybeans, 8.55 and a half the high, the low at 8.41 and a half. Settlement price at 8.51 and a quarter, up 4 and three quarters. August futures 8.39 and three quarters the high, the low at 27. Settlement price at 8.34 and a quarter, finished 0.75 cents higher. Those nearby contracts were held up, by the way, on commercial buying, especially in the May contract today. September futures in the soybean pit, 8.14 and a quarter the high, the low at 7.98 and a half. Settlement price a penny and a half lower at $8.06. In November beans, and down a penny and three quarters, 7.99 and a half the high, the low at 7.84. Settlement price at 7.91 and a quarter, down 1 and a half, or rather 1 and three quarters of a cent for the November soybeans. March bean meal futures, 7.10 the high, That can't be right, can it? March bean meal futures, a settlement price at $271.70, up $3.90. May futures, $264.70, up $3.90 for the afternoon. March bean oil futures, a 30.19 settlement price, 9 cents higher. May futures at 30.42, up 8 cents for the day. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. More from the CME Group and the livestock side in a moment. Just a quick reminder that I'll be back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today, when we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, about the commodity markets. And that coming up in just 1 week, we'll be at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, for our all-day agricultural outlook meeting. It's a good one and better this year than ever before. Check out the lineup on our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Livestock contracts finished higher today in Chicago. April live cattle, 84.65 the high, 83.80 the low. The settlement, 84.22 and a half, that up 27 and a half. June, 82.85 the high, 82.05 the low, 82.45 the settlement, that up 25. August, 83.60 the high, 82.95 the low, 83.35 the settlement, that up 40. October, 87.25 the high, 86.50 the low, 86.90 the settlement, that up 20. March feeder cattle, 92.15 the high, 91.55 the low, 91.97 and a half the settlement, that up 52 and a half. April, 93.15 the high, 92.45 the low, 92.80 the settlement, that up 45. May, 94.72 and a half the high, 93.95 the low, 94.32 and a half the settlement, that up 27 and a half. And August, 97.50 the high, 96.70 the low, the settlement, 97.40, that up 22 and a half. April lean hog, 61.35 the high, 60.30 the low, 60.85 the settlement, that winding up 57 and a half cents higher today. May, 70.85 the high, 70.10 the low, 70.67 and a half the settlement, that up 42 and a half. June, 72.45 the high, 71.45 the low, the settlement, 71.77 and a half, that up 30. July lean hog, 74.30 the high, 73.30 the low, the settlement, 73.95, up 32 and a half. And May bellies, 80.05 the high, 77.50 the low, the settlement, 78.55, that down 55. The Dow is up 74 points at 68.37. The Dow at 68.37. The NASDAQ up 19 points at 1342. The S&P 500 7 higher at 707. Nearby crude trading up 150 at 41.60 in New York at the Mercantile Exchange.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities, hosting planning seminars at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 3rd in Watseka, Illinois, and at 3 p.m. Wednesday, March 4th in Terre Haute, Indiana. More information is available at 866-837-9027.
2 minutes before 2 o'clock, here's the weather forecast for Illinois and Indiana as prepared by Mike Sola. This afternoon, increasing cloudiness, highs ranging from 30 in northern Indiana to 40 in far southern Illinois. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, lows ranging from 15 in eastern Indiana to 30 in western Illinois. Tomorrow in northern Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy, elsewhere mostly sunny. Highs ranging from near 40 in northern Indiana to 57 in southwestern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, partly sunny, the high 34, the wind from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low 25, the wind from the southeast at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, breezy, and milder, the high around 50, the wind from the south at 12 to 24 miles per hour. The outlook for Thursday, partly sunny, breezy, and mild, the high near 60. And Friday, mostly cloudy, with a chance of a shower or two, the high 60. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Coming up, news from National Public Radio and the closing market report with Todd Gleason. Stay tuned.